Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, our weekly radio magazine of the performing arts here on Local Public Radio, KALW. I'm your host, David LaTulip. Today I'll be talking with Casey Lee Hurt and Ian Merrigan from the creative team of The Unfortunates, a darkly comic musical that's currently playing at ACT's Strand Theater on Market Street. Also a conversation with Laura Elaine Ellis, Cherie Hill, and Kendra Kimbrough Barnes about the Black Choreographers Festival, presenting its Next Wave Choreographers Showcase this weekend at Dance Mission Theater. And Danish-Israeli violinist Nikolai Znaider shares details about his upcoming performances of the Nielsen Violin Concerto with the San Francisco Symphony. Stay tuned. The Black Choreographers Festival presents Next Wave Choreographers Showcase, New Voices, New Works, this weekend at Dance Mission Theater on 24th Street in San Francisco. A number of collaborations have been forged for the festival, and here in studio to share some of the details is Laura Elaine Ellis, who is the BCF co-director. Welcome to you, Laura.
David, thanks for inviting us.
Of course. And she is joined by Cherie Hill, who directs Irie Dance, a company which draws on Black feminist theory, African aesthetics, and contemporary Western dance. Welcome to you, Cherie.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Also in studio to talk about the production is co-founder of the festival, Kendra Kimbrough Barnes, who co-founded K-Star Productions in 1996, which focuses on cultural exchange experiences accessible to the community at large and with a special focus on African-American constituents. K-Star Productions is producing this weekend's festival. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Well, Laura Elaine Ellis, let's start with a brief overview of this weekend's festival, if you would.
Well, the new works and the new voices that we're going to have on stage, the new voices speaks directly to the emerging artist. We had an incredible artist mentoring program that took place this year, and established artists Robert Moses, Gregory Dawson, Deborah Vaughn, Raisa Simpson, and
Joanna Highgood.
Yes, and Joanna Highgood. They went into the studio with artists that were emerging. Eric Lee, Dazon Solian, and Jocelyn Mathis Reed all have works on this weekend's concert, and they helped them to develop ideas that they had, just creations that they were thinking about putting on stage over 6 months' time, working in studio with these mentoring artists. They developed brand new works. That is a cornerstone of the programming. And then there are incredible mid-career and established artists that fill out that program. Gregory Dawson, who is also a mentor, he is collaborating with some of the dancers in his company to present. We have Amranjiru Kamuwayu. Coming on, you right. She is setting a piece on the Mills Repertory Company. And then there's Chris Evans, who's doing an exciting collaboration with Beeb Chanel Bibini, mm-hmm. and David Boyce of the Brown Fellinis.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, of course, in studio, we have the amazing Cherie Hill.
Which we'll hear
presenting.
From shortly. It sounds
and then
like
on
a
Sunday,
weekend.
Yeah, Sunday we
That's
have.
That's just Saturday.
That's Saturday. And then Sunday, joining the program is Jamie Wright and Felicia Stroud. And what I want you to know is that there's this amazing blend of expression, because the pieces that will be on stage really span the gamut of classical ballet to hip hop, a lot of contemporary modern with very current and contemporary sensibilities from the hip hop language, and like jitting, which is this new dance. Well, I don't know if it's new, but it's a very prominent dance style in Chicago.
It would be new to me.
Yeah. Right. And then we also have pieces where artists are responding to their time. So one of the reasons we talk about new works is these are all premieres or very new, like just created this year. And some of them are in direct response to things happening in the world today that are impacting African and African-American artists. So it gives them a space for expressing their world and telling their stories.
So this is really a culminating weekend there. There's been a lot that's been going on in the months preceding this, this jam-packed weekend of events.
That is right. There's a lot of what we like to call like front-milling, just a lot of preparation. And it's wonderful that Kendra and I get to provide opportunities for artists to not just show up and put a dance on stage, but actually have the time to develop these new works.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit with Kendra. In addition to feeding Laura some answers to some of the choreographer's name, what exactly goes into producing an event like this?
Well, I just want to say that one of the things that Laura and I really appreciate with the festival is not only being able to get introduced to new artists, but also becoming members of their audiences during their season as well. So it's a way to showcase choreographers and have them develop their audience. Production is fun and all-inclusive. You know, we have a good time sitting down to discuss what artists are going to be presenting and selecting artists for our artist mentorship program. But we try to stand back a little bit in terms of what they actually bring to the festival. And it's really refreshing to be able to see them bringing work that does represent the state of our community and our society. And so, like Laura was mentioning, this year, Eric Lee is doing a piece, a solo dance by Justin Sherman, and it's in direct response to the Black Lives Matter movement. And the solo is dedicated to those that have lost their lives through police brutality. So it's really
quite timely.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then Chris Evans is working with
that's Beep Chanel.
Beep Chanel and David Boyce.
Oh, now they're reversed there.
We have each other's back.
What you need to know is it's a co-produced event.
Yeah,
we co-produce and we co-direct and we co-curate.
And you co-finish each other's sentences.
Exactly.
As a result.
It's over 12 years.
Good for you. Nice.
We know what we're thinking. And it's a community event, too. We have community sponsors like Dance Mission Theater and Dance Brigade. In the past, ODC Theater and Yerba Buena Center for the Arts.
Great collaborations.
Dimensions Dance Theater has always been of support. So when you talk about producing, we can't do it alone. Mm-hmm. Like, it wouldn't be the same all community minded event if it was just one mind.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. And it's important to realize too that the Black Choreographers Festival isn't just this weekend. There are things that are happening all year round.
That is right.
Including an important educational aspect.
Exactly. Yep.
So what is going on? Are you going into individual schools? Are you presenting showcases or?
We typically have public symposia, and we always have a Q&A after our performances, so audiences have an opportunity to engage with the artist and get to talk about the work and ask questions and share what their feedback and impact was seeing the piece. We partnered with Dance Mission Theater and the Dirt Festival this past month in January and co-sponsored an amazing panel discussion, What is the Matter of Our Lives, with Delina Patrice Brooks and Delina Dream Productions. Mm-hmm. And that had some amazing community activists on the panel that also are artists. And we had a very full house, and they were talking about issues about self-care and sometimes being on the front lines of what your community needs in challenging times.
These are challenging times, and the Bay Area is ripe for the picking for
right.
having people that are not only involved directly in some of these crises, yeah. but being of an artistic bent to help bring them to light in an artistic
That's
way.
That's right, and we will be Kendra and I will be presenting things during the Bay Area Celebrates National Dance Week this spring. And then Kendra will be heading
more in August at Laney College, which in Oakland, which will be August, I think, 26th through the 28th. So it's great to be busting out of February. That's our theme that we've been going with, because we have been in mainly in February for the past, I think, 10 years. But it really is in alignment with our vision to be having other community partnerships and definitely able to offer artists more platforms to perform throughout the year. And then also doing partnerships with West Wave Dance Festival, which is at C-Space, usually in the fall. So,
and the summer will be the frame for our youth professional. Well, mm-hmm. It's the professional youth companies, and so that will have more of the educational component for young artists who are passionate about dance and theater and performing.
Fantastic. I mean, this all sounds like it's all very worthwhile, but talk to me a little bit about funding. How has funding been going, and where is it coming from, and is it fairly steady? Obviously, we could always use more here at KLW as well.
Absolutely.
Kendra?
You know, we have very gracious to the funders that have helped to make BCF what it is, Zellerbach Family Foundation, both the San Francisco Arts Commission, as well as Oakland cultural funding programs are
Kenneth Rainin Foundation.
Also East Bay Community Foundation. So we have a nice, solid foundation support. We are definitely always trying to foster and nurture our individual donors. And that can always, you know, folks can always go to our website and help to support the festival, which is bcfhereandnow.com. And yeah, it's grueling, but Laura and I both do grant writing for our organizations and come together and try to make it happen each year.
We share our resources. The community partners that we have often sponsor segments of the festival to make things possible. So we sometimes get subsidized theater rentals. They will sometimes help us with our master classes. If we give a film series or if we have artists that are visiting, we can often reach out to community partners, and they will come in with us on particular master classes that serve the community and help reduce the cost that it would typically take to
have something special.
It's all about collaboration,
isn't it?
Yeah, we always knew that we wanted to have a consortium sort of model for this and share resources.
That's Laura Ellis, co-director of the Black Choreographers Festival, talking here with Kendra Kimbrough Barnes, who is founder of K-Star Productions and is co-producing this weekend's festival. Also part of the conversation, I'd like to invite Cherie Evan, Cherie Hill. Mm-hmm. Yes. No, see, we're all feeding each other names.
You are now part of the team.
We're bringing you on.
I'm stuck now. Cherie Hill, your showcase is an excerpt from a work which was premiered last June in Oakland for a sextet of women to some reggae music. Tell us about Terrestrial Footprints.
Yeah, so Terrestrial Footprints was originally an evening-length piece, and it's danced to reggae dub music by Bri Zion, rearranged by Peter Lionheart, and it features six female dancers, including myself. And the idea came out of actually a teaching project I was working on for a few years called Creative Movement in the African Aesthetic, and I was looking at ways that I could take some of the concepts and essences of West African dance, traditional dances, and Afro-Caribbean traditional dances that I'd learned, and put that in a more improvisational context. I teach creative dance and modern dance improvisation to children and teens at Luna Dance Institute, and I wanted to bring in some of that knowledge. So I started that teaching project, kind of experimented teaching different classes to students in Oakland and at the National Dance Education Organization Conference in Miami. I taught at the Dance World of Hope Festival to adults, a contemporary class, and kind of brought in some elements of contracting and expanding and undulations through an improvisational structure. And as the project developed, I decided last year to bring it into performance. So that's kind of where Terrestrial Footprint started.
What will we see this sextet performing on stage?
So this weekend we're showing excerpts from three sections called Air, Vortex, and Watcher.
Fantastic. And the music, you said, is kind of an amalgam of different styles.
The music is dub reggae music, so it has roots in reggae music coming from the islands in Jamaica, but it's electronic-based, so there's a lot of effects like reverberation and echo and time-lapse, and for me, it kind of brings the music to a more celestial place, and as a contemporary dancer, I feel like it gives a lot of space for me to be able to choreograph different feelings and expressions to it. So I've been working with dub music for the last few years, making some dance films called Dub Dance Project to different tunes. I'm also part of Interstanding Sound, which is an Oakland-based dub music crew. And we have events every month, all-night reggae dub music events every month with a large sound system. So that's kind of been my experience in bringing that into the more contemporary concert dance.
And is that with live performers as well?
Yes, live performers and lyricists.
This weekend's performances, is that with live performances or recorded?
No, it will be recorded music with the dancers. Mm-hmm.
Although Chris Evans' piece has live music, she's a cellist as well as a dancer choreographer. And Beeb will be playing live drums, and then David Boyce, of course, is musical director, and he'll be grooving as well live.
Fantastic.
And Jocelyn Mathis Reed actually will have live computer music happening in the moment.
So. Nice. Cherie, the music that you brought, is that from what we'll hear this weekend at the festival?
Yes. The music is by Bri Zion, who's based in San Diego. It's called Deeper Dub. And it'll be part of the water section that you'll see this weekend.
Well, thanks for bringing that in, and we look forward to this weekend's performances.
Thank you.
It's the Black Choreographers Festival. Thank you, Laura Ellis, for coming in, as well as Kendra Kimbrough Barnes. Have a wonderful festival.
Thank you so much, David. Thanks for supporting.
Information about the festival at bcfhereandnow.com. It's at the Dance Mission Theater this weekend, 24th Street in San Francisco. Still to come on Open Air, a conversation with Nikolai Znaider about his performances with the San Francisco Symphony this weekend. Well, in 2013, a new musical took the Oregon Shakespeare Festival by storm. It blended bluesy grit with contemporary syncopation and told the story of Big Joe, a tough-talking soldier who signs up for war but falls into a shadowy dream world in which he must fight to save his love. The musical, called The Unfortunates, was created by John Beavers, Christopher Diaz, Casey Lee Hurt, Ramiz Monsef, and Ian Merrigan, the latter of two who join me in the studio. Ian Merrigan is the co-creator and plays Big Joe in the show. He's a writer, actor, and musician from Kansas City, Missouri, currently based in Los Angeles. In addition to work with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, he's been seen in productions for Soho Rep, Circle X Theater, as well as the Seattle Shakespeare Company. And his music has been featured on IFC, ABC, NBC, several other letters, incurring current TV, and Hulu. Hulu can also be found online. And he's a graduate of the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. So very pleased to welcome you to Open Air, Ian.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And he's joined by musical director and co-creator Casey Lee Hurt, who is a third-generation former Southern Baptist preacher, who started playing music at the age of 12 when he was handed a pawn shop guitar and an old hymnal. His music, has, in addition to being part of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival presentation in 2013, he led the band in the Berkeley Rep and South Coast Rep productions of One Man, Two Governors, an amazing show, by the way. And in 2015, he won the International Songwriting Competition for his blues song, Sin Perfume. Also writing for television shows, including Criminal Minds, Pretty Little Liars, and One Tree Hill. Casey Lee Hurt, welcome to Open Air as well.
Thank you so much.
Well, the show itself is called The Unfortunates. It runs through April 12th at ACT's new space on Market Street. Let's hear a little bit of what the inspiration. I understand there's a song that was part of the main inspiration for the show.
That's right. That's right. The St. James Infirmary Blues.
Well, let's hear that, and we'll talk more about the creative process and how it came from song to show and what happened in between. More with Casey and Ian after the St. James Blues, St. James Infirmary.
Barkeep, give me another shot of that old crow. Tell you a little story about my friend Big Joe. Said I was down in old Joe's bar room, right there in the square. All the usual suspects was assembled. Big Joe McKinney was there. He said,
"Boys, I wanna tell you a story."
His eyes were all bloodshot red. Well, he leaned down real low and he told me these were the words he said.
I went down to St. James Infirmary. I heard my baby groan. She was stretched out on a long white table. She used to be my very own.
Oh, let her go, God bless her. Wherever she may be, she can search that wide world over. She won't never find a meaner man than me. When I die, bury me in straight lace shoes, a box back coat, and a Stetson hat, and put a $20 gold chain on my daddy's old watch, so those boys know I died standing pat.
And give me six crap shooters for pallbearers. Let a chorus girl sing me a song.
Put a red hot jazz band on my funeral march. Raise hell as I roll along.
Roll out your old time carriage. I say roll out your old time hat. There's 12 men going down to the graveyard, and 11 are coming back.
Well, Big Joe, he's one mighty box man.
But the plague took the woman in love.
Like it took old King Jesse before her. It'll come take us all, for it's done.
Now that I told my story, pour another shot of booze. And if anyone should ever ask me, yeah, yeah, well, I got those St. James Infirmary blues. Yeah, yeah.
I went down. I went down. I went down. Oh, I went down.
Casey Lee Hurt and Company, featuring Christopher Diaz, co-creator in St. James Infirmary, the inspiration for The Unfortunates at the Strand Theater, presented through ACT. Casey, so this story is more than just about the blues. Let's get some background for what the storyline is. What's the through line for The Unfortunates?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, as you said, the St. James Infirmary blues, for us actually as creators, when we first met up, it was a song that we all cared deeply about and started to sing, and just kind of, you know, we would just do it a cappella, just gather around in a circle and start to sing it. And what we found is that it gave us a very interesting framework for this storyline of this character named Big Joe McKinney, who, you know, essentially goes off to war and leaves the woman he loves and, you know, fights death and you know, eventually ends up coming back and realizing that even though he evaded death, you know, over at war, he comes back and death is still on his doorstep. And so that was really the heart and kind of root of the idea that we got. And then we took it from there and ran and developed different storylines and through lines and characters from blues tradition and made it our own. So,
mm-hmm. And you're speaking of wartime. Is it specific wartime or just wartime in general that you're portraying
just,
here?
Yeah, it's just wartime in general. You know, I one of the things that was very important to me as we continue to create this, really important to all of us, is that there is a cultural heritage that we have in America with music that seems to go in and out of every war that we've ever had. And it, you know, for better or worse, that is one thing that we have in our culture, is we've always had war and we've always had music. And I think that music serves to help sing out and fight injustice and find solace in moments of tragedy. And so for us, it didn't feel as important to specify a specific war as much as it did the idea of war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's Casey Lee Hurt, one of the co-creators of The Unfortunates, here with co-creator Ian Murrigan, who plays the lead, Big Joe.
Yes.
Big Joe.
Big Joe.
Tell me about
him. Well, So, you know, like Casey said, when we got this song, the St. James Infirmary Blues, we knew we wanted to make something out of it. We knew we had some given facts, and one of those was that there was this character, Big Joe McKinney, and that he was dealing with the loss of someone he loved, and he was sort of then turning and saying, you know, when I die, here's how I want you to remember me. Put a jazz band on my funeral march. Celebrate me. You know, and so we wanted to take a story of a person who was sort of in a position of, you know, confidence, maybe bordering on arrogance. I have to play him, so I don't call him arrogant. I think he's
a great guy.
He thinks very highly of himself, and he's responsible for on a sort of raucous and wonderful night, getting his friends to sign up with him for war, and then they find themselves in a very dire situation in a prison, sort of waiting to be executed. And then all of a sudden, all of that courage and all of that braggadocio has left him. And so the story then that happens is Big Joe kind of is visited by this dream. And in the dream, he has to lose love and face a number of obstacles to kind of find true courage and be able to face what we ultimately all have to face. Mm. Hopefully not by firing squad, obviously, but you know, he is Yeah, as far as I see him, he's a lovable, sweet,
handsome.
He's extremely. He's got a face for radio.
I was going to say
he's very strong.
Hold that mug up to the microphone for us.
Yeah, you know, in the course of the dream, he winds up getting these sort of various comic booky elements. One of our creators, Ramiz Montsef, very influenced by comic books and graphic novels, and so a lot of our imagery draws from that. So Joe acquires these giant fists, and the enemy that was haunting Joe becomes a doctor who has these long, all-encompassing arms, and Joe's love is actually without arms, and it's this sort of...
So a fantastical sort of visual.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Neat. Well, musicals historically have an often long, angst-ridden road from concept to fruition. Can you maybe share with us some war stories from the road to this musical?
Casey, I'll let you.
Yeah. Well, you know, with any collaborative process, there, you know, you always come up on moments of conflict and of, I don't know, ideas go in separate directions. And I would say that in general, you know, we've had our fair share of fights and arm wrestling matches and things like that. And the one thing that has been true, though, throughout all of it, is we had this one vision and this one seed of an idea that was, if you only have a few moments left in life, are those moments still worth living to the fullest? And how do we tell that story? And so at the end of the day, you know, no matter how many different conflicts we have or ideas or battles that we fight, we end up falling back to that idea and that truth. And if it doesn't vibe with that truth, then usually the idea gets dropped or changed, and it's not without some fit throwing and, you know, stomping out of more than one restaurant, I would say I've done myself, but but, you know, we find it at the end, and I think that we're all better for it because of that journey.
Yeah. Well, Casey, I understand that in addition to providing the music, you're also considered the idea distillery, keeping things focused. And as a project like this can, I'm sure, branch out, you've got to pull things, rein things in.
Yeah, I am honored to be considered that. You know, I think that we've all done that at different times. And, like I said, at the end of the day, that I think that for us, it's we are excitable. We're an excitable bunch, you know, and we really live in a yes and environment when we create with each other. Mm. And the brilliance and also the trouble with that is that yes ands can grow to an enormous size, and you can have ideas and songs and ideas that take off in a thousand different directions.
Sure.
And so, so for me, and, you know, and specifically with the music, there's a through current and a heart that I try to keep my finger on the pulse of.
Ian Merrigan, maybe you can give us an example of a quaff from the Casey Lee Hurt distillery idea. Where did he bring something from a larger idea to something that was a little bit more distilled and focused?
Oh, I actually have a great story, like, right on the top of my head for that. And it ties back into the you know, drama in the drama question. Yeah. From before, which is sort of one of the when you're collaborating with a number of individuals and tensions get high, we were having a workshop at ACT here in San Francisco, which has just been like such a dream to work on this piece in this town. I feel like Yes. The energy of this city feeds us and believes in music and believes in the power of mystery and storytelling in such an incredible way that getting to be here has been really incredible. However, one workshop we were having was starting to look like maybe we were never going to speak to each other ever again. And then, like you do, you get up and you go to work anyway. And we came to work. And on that day, something struck all of a sudden. I think Shauna Cooper, our director, had been asking this question. And all of a sudden it hit us of a character that had been a part of the show at OSF. And freeing up some real estate by moving some of that text, and we all of a sudden realized that actually if we took that character out of the play, it would free up a lot of real estate. And that character belonged to another of the creators, John Beavers, who sort of in an act that really represents what the whole process is, was like, absolutely, put it on the cutting floor. Let's tell the truest story. Mm-hmm. So in the course of that, we came down to needing to write this particular song that is in the show that is about this plague that, you know, P.S. also, there's a plague, about this plague that's running rampant through this dream. And so we all had our assignments of go off and write two stanzas about this plague. And so we took our lunch break and everybody went. And we wrote these really hilarious phrases about the terrible things that'll happen to you when you get the plague and, you know, horrifying, terrible things. And we came back with our stanzas, and Casey had broken the rules and written two stanzas that that brought the whole song directly back to the main conflict of the story, which is that Joe is actually in a prison cell having this dream and being confronted by it.
Wow.
So all of a sudden, this song that is, you know, plasmodic necrosis leads to necroveliosis, was a major halitosis and a focus on the end. Then you think you're smelling toast, but you're just having a stroke and you're hoping that you're croak, but first your world is going to spin.
that
kind of song then transformed into, so you go to the recruiter and they issue you a gun and he tells you you're a hero and that war is a lot of fun. Then they throw you in a prison cell and murder all your friends and they tell you that you'll never see your family again. So you hallucinate a dream and you try to fall in love, but you'll never love a coward. It don't matter what he does. So you wallow in your misery and die upon your knees and no one will remember you or even hear your screams.
Wow.
And it becomes this extremely haunting, poignant moment that just bangs like a gong through the show. And it really, you know, to me, that's a really great example of how through keeping us in the compass of the music that we need to be in and in the story we need to be in, Casey really kept the arrow pointing in the direction we wanted to go.
Nice. Good work. Ian, tell us a little bit about your fellow castmates.
Oh, man, we have just an unbelievable cast. Janet Foster is the casting director at ACT, and along with Carrie Perloff and Beatrice and Don Scott and the whole artistic staff over there, they helped us put together a team of absolutely incredible actors. There's a couple of local Bay Area actors that I think people who follow theater around here will probably know. Taylor Iman Jones is just, she plays Ray and is extraordinary, and Amy Lizardo is also a Bay Area actor. She plays Handsome Carl and is terrific. Christopher Livingston, I know, was in Party People over at Berkeley Rep, and he was one of our original cast members when we were creating this thing in 2010 in Oregon. So it's wild to have him back. Eddie Lopez is a Bay Area native and a really tremendous actor and collaborator. Danielle Herbert, just incredible voice. Lauren Hart and Artie Wise are members of the conservatory over at ACT. And, you know, then with the creative team on top, the rest of us are, you know, Rami's and John and myself and Casey.
It sounds like a wonderful group of guys.
It's, it really
and,
is.
And gal.
It's an, and gals. I mean, it really is an unbelievable team. You know when you're going to work at a theater like ACT in a city like San Francisco, you're going to have extraordinary talent. And so that's a given,
right,
which is nice when you're in a city like this.
And then to have the venue of ACT in the Strand is tremendous.
Yeah, and then to add that extra, we talk about, there's this concept of when you sing, it creates, every once in a while when you sing a harmony that's not necessarily a perfect harmony, it's just the perfect harmony for the moment, this sort of magic note is created on top. And that magic note is the thing that you don't necessarily always get, even in a really talented cast. And in this cast, there really is like that magic note.
Nice. It's Ian Merrigan. He is Big Joe in The Unfortunates at ACT, the Strand Theater, here with Casey Lee Hurt, the co-creator and musical director. Casey, I understand that there's more than just blues in the score. We heard the St. James Infirmary to start off with. What else did you come up with?
Yeah, well, as we were creating the piece, one of the things that felt very exciting was as we were telling this, well, I should start back by saying The St. James Infirmary Blues is a beautiful song, and I think specifically in the American heritage, because it has taken so many different forms. It was St. James Infirmary Blues, but before that it was The Unfortunate Rake. For all of you Johnny Cash fans, it was The Streets of Laredo. And so it evolved in a lot of different ways, and that was the seed and the really kind of potent idea that got us going with this. It also made us realize that we had an opportunity to tell the story of American music throughout this musical, in addition to this Big Joe story. So we pull from a lot of different genres. We pull from blues and jazz and hip hop and traditional folk stylings and more of the like 70s Joe Cocker ballads, and really just tried to take that journey and show that specifically that each style of music and each genre actually influences the next style in a way that is greater than the sum of the parts. So that it creates this kind of beautiful melting pot that is American musical culture. And specifically with hip hop, it's been something that we've really loved and adored for, you know, all of the creators have loved for a very long time. And so using that and using the language of hip hop underneath, you know, maybe a musical arrangement that is more of a ballad or more of a jazz tune, or even a folk song, it really tunes our ears in a different way to learning how to listen to that and I think appreciate different styles.
We're going to go out with the tune from the sound from you guys performing, Down and Out. Tell us about that tune.
Yeah, Down and Out. It was a song actually that, you know, I feel like for myself is at many times in the creative process you hit slumps and maybe dry spells where you haven't written something in a long time. And I remember very specifically I was laying on the couch feeling sorry for myself and I started just playing my ukulele and all of a sudden I started singing Down and Out, Down and Out. I'm feeling down and out. And then I got the spark that, this is the seed of a song that belongs in the show. And I ran down and I met Ian in the laundromat that was near us. And we started playing the song together. And it came out of that. So
yeah.
Well, here it is. Down and Out, music of Casey Lee Hurt. Have a great run, Ian Merrigan. You do the same, Big Joe.
Thank you so much.
The Unfortunates is at ACT, the Strand on Market Street, through April 10th, act-sf.org for more information. Down,
that you've been hoping for a little trouble to come around. Well, you're in luck, friend, because I'm in town. You need more than a game of craps or that alley crowd. You need to feel a touch of faith. A faith. Will my friend the healer's on his way. Just follow me down and out and down and out and down and out and down. Just follow me
down and out from the Unfortunates again at the ACT Strand Theater on Market Street through April 10th. act-sf.org for more information. Danish-born violinist Nikolaj Znaider is featured with the San Francisco Symphony in concerts tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday. Guest conductor Stefan Denev leads Znaider, who is also a highly regarded conductor, in Carl Nielsen's Violin Concerto, a work Znaider recently recorded with Alan Gilbert and the New York Philharmonic. Also on the program, Guillaume Canesson's A Glimmer in the Age of Darkness, which is part two of his Cosmic Trilogy, and selections from Serge Prokofiev's ballet Cinderella. Znaider has been a soloist with many major orchestras of the world and now conducts them regularly as well. His award-winning recordings include the Brahms and Korngold concertos with Valery Gergiev and the Vienna Philharmonic, the Beethoven and Mendelssohn concertos with Zubin Mehta and the Israeli Philharmonic, and Prokofiev's Concerto No. 2 together with the Glazunov Concerto with Maris Janssens and the Bavarian Radio Symphony. Mr. Znaider has also recorded the complete works for violin and piano of Brahms with Yefim Bronfman. Later this spring, he will spend 2 weeks as both soloist and conductor with the National Symphony. I caught up with him backstage at Davies Symphony Hall in between rehearsals yesterday. While time didn't permit a further conversation with guest conductor Stefan Denev, we'll hear him, somewhat muffled, on piano going over the Nielsen score in an adjacent dressing room towards the end of my talk with Nikolaj. Nikolaj, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you.
I have to admit an unfamiliarity with this particular work of Carl Nielsen, the violin concerto, although I'm very familiar with the music of the Great Dane. It has to have one of the most unusual openings ever for a violin concerto, where you start with almost 2 minutes of an accompanied cadenza.
Yeah, well, and that is actually, in my opinion, the only unusual thing about the concerto. is as you say, the fact that it opens with an extended introduction. After that, it's business as usual. You know, there's a long first movement with a big virtuosic cadenza, a solo opportunity for the main instrument, a slow second movement, and the last movement rondo. So it's very standard piece with a slight unusual twist that I think make people recoil. Is a strong word, but make people kind of feel they don't know how to approach it.
Mm-hmm. Well, usually in a concerto, we're given some material first, with which the soloist will then riff on for a cadenza, but that isn't the case. Does some of this material that you play in the opening cadenza come back in the work?
No, as I said, the opening is an add-on, if you will, and the main movement is then business as usual, meaning that the material reworked in the cadenza is in fact from the main movement. So if we took that out of the equation, or if we'd made it a little bit shorter, I think it would have been easier for people to grasp. I think it's a wonderful and beautiful opening, beautiful introduction that maybe is not essential for the piece, but beautiful nonetheless.
Well, you are Danish-born, so I imagine Nielsen is ingrained in your very psyche at an early age.
Yeah, well, it was a piece I learned when I was very young. I think I was 15 or 16. So, yeah, for me, it came naturally. So, you know, it was Nielsen's 150th birthday last year, and I played the piece a few times, conducted symphonies. And in all the interviews, it was always the same question, you know, why is it not more popular? Why is it so strange? And to me, it really isn't, you know, because I grew up with it. So in this case, I suppose it's a case of infamiliarity breeding, if not contempt, then at least kind of fear of getting too close.
You mentioned that, we know that that opening cadenza isn't the only cadenza. It gets to be quite playful, and then you've got some real meaty work to do as a concerto soloist with cadenzas that happen later in the work.
Yes, that's an idea which coincidentally also Sibelius used in the first version of his violin concerto. Before he removed that cadenza in the last moment, there is indeed another solo episode in the finale, but so does Beethoven. Beethoven has that too, you know. So it's not, to me, it's like I said, I don't feel it quite as strange. I think there are two things that make people not play it as much as it should be played, and the introduction we talked about, and the fact it ends loudly, but it's kind of humorous loud. It's not a thing that gets people jumping out of their seats. I think that's unfortunately too many people think about, you know, how am I going to get a big applause. Mm-hmm.
Carl Nielsen was also a violinist. Does that show in his writing for the concerto?
I think it's very well written for the violin. I think it shows good understanding. I think, though, that good composers knew how to find information. You know, Brahms used his friend Joseph Joachim. Before that, all the composers were familiar with stringed instruments, played stringed instruments to some extent. And certainly, even though Nielsen was not a great violinist, but he knew enough to understand the possibilities of the instrument.
Well, as you mentioned, this isn't as widely known as other concertos for the instrument. What can you offer a first-time listener who is going to hear the Nielsen for the first time? What should they be listening for?
Well, it's like any other great piece of music. You don't have to listen for anything. You don't have to look for meaning. You know, if you're open-minded, like with anything in life, I suppose, it's a piece that actually is for enjoyment. You know, it's not a piece that's difficult to listen to, in my opinion, even though I grew up with it. I think there are other works of Nielsen that come to mind, the later symphonies, the Sixth Symphony. That's a bit strange, and some other works. But this one is very, I think it has beautiful tunes. It has, you know, all the things you expect from a good violin concerto.
Tell us about the wonderful instrument you're playing. I believe it's a 1741 Guarnerius. How did you come about this instrument?
You know, if you have a lot of money, it's not so hard. But that was a difficult part. You know, there were some lovely people, the Velox Foundation, that purchased this instrument. And it was for sale. I believe had been sitting in a collection in the United States for a few years. Many years, in fact, and a terrific instrument that used to be the concert instrument of Fritz Kreisler, actually. Exactly 100 years ago now. So, yeah, it's a very special instrument. I'm very happy to be lucky to be playing it.
You recently recorded the Elgar Concerto for violin, with which Fritz Kreisler played this violin on.
That's right. That we found that out after the violin was purchased. We found letters where he's talking about that was the instrument on which he played all concerts, all recordings between the years of 1904, 1919, I think. And the violin concerto was premiered in 1910. And we realized, my God, that's the violin. So we made a big to-do with my mentor, the great Sir Colin Davis, who, of course, knew this piece intimately. We played it everywhere and recorded it as well. It's kind of an amazing year it was, actually, of Elgar year, with the same violin 100 years later.
How does that quite work with this instrument being on loan from someone's collection?
Well, it's the second best version, you know. You get to play it. That's how it works. Since the violin is not meant for me, it's meant for the greater good of the community. There's some kind of stipulation. That means that I'm engaged in community activities and teaching children once a year, something like that, you know. And I have to, of course, there are conditions that I have to meet, you know. If I decide to stop playing the violin and become a skier, you know, they'll take it away, but, you know, so...
Something tells me you're not bringing the Guarnerius to young kids in the schools.
No, but not long ago, I did bring it in a kindergarten, which had nothing to do with the violin. It was just something I believe in a lot, actually. I think that the problems, quote-unquote, of classical music, or the challenges, let's say, is, for me, the fact that too many young people grow up and go through all of their childhood, youth, and early adulthood with not having had any contact with music. This is a new phenomenon. It used to be that any home, not very poor homes, but any home of a median income would have a piano at home, and people would play and they would sing, not the classical music, but there would be music in the house. That has completely disappeared. What has led to, in Europe, maybe here you will feel this too, in Europe we feel it more because everything is government subsidized, we feel that we've lost a generation or two. It means that the generation of people in charge now, politicians, are unfamiliar with arts, and they don't understand the importance of art and try to look for reasons why not to support it. Well, it doesn't produce any scientists, it doesn't do well. It's very hard to quantify why art is important. And so I think the only salvation from this situation is showing kids, and I don't mean high school kids, that's too late. I don't even mean middle school kids, because they are busy sending paper airplanes through the concert hall when they are bussed into rehearsals. But we need to find the little kids and make them not passive listening to music, but show them the not joy, but the thrill and the essential emotional need that humans actually have for self-expression that they can experience in music, whether it's community projects where they play open strings on a violin in a bigger orchestra and they suddenly feel they are part of this greater sound. Whatever it is, something has to be done to salvage the next generation, so we don't have more generations that are lost to music and beauty of creation.
Your association with the name Carl Nielsen also goes in this educational aspect of your being chair of the International Carl Nielsen Violin Competition.
Yeah, it was first they asked me to do it. I said no, because I don't like competitions. I think it's a bizarre thing, although I did many myself. But then I thought, actually, perhaps this is a situation where I can do some good. On one hand, we can hopefully help identify talented young artists and help them in launching their careers. That was one of two conditions I had, that the prize is not only money and a bouquet of flowers and good luck, but concerts. Because that's what you need when you're starting a career. So we wanted to provide them with concert opportunities, with orchestras, with recital halls, et cetera, et cetera. And the other thing was, I said, it must be something that becomes a celebration of the violin and music and in general, and, of course, the violin in particular. So we are starting the whole competition with a giant concert in which I will also conduct a little something, play a little something, with many, I don't know how many kids we have, but from all over Denmark that are coming and rehearsing all spring, all winter, and, you know, we'll then meet finally in Odense when the competition begins in a live televised thing. So I think it's an opportunity to do good, actually.
That's great that you're able to help mold what that competition offers. That's what's wonderful. Speaking of conducting that you'll be doing there, you've been doing more and more conducting, most recently appointed principal guest conductor of the Mariinsky Symphony in St. Petersburg. Do you see a time where conducting takes more of your artistic energy than solo violin?
Well, it is already. You know, I'm conducting 10 years already. And Mariinsky since 2008, 2009, something like that. So it's already taking a lot of time, which is not in of itself a problem. The only challenge, again, problem sounds negative, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But the only challenge remains to keep in shape on the violin, because the music always boils in me, always cooking. So whether I play or conduct is just different outlets for the same musical need for expression. So the only thing is just the physical aspect, just keeping, you know, you do several things. You know that the instrument, as opposed to conducting, where you're not playing an instrument as such, the instrument is unforgiving, you know, it's a jealous mistress that you know, punishes you if you're not attentive enough. So that's the only thing. And I promised myself I don't want to stop playing. It was one thing I promised myself. And I still love playing a lot, I have to say. But my second promise to myself was not to let my level drop because of the conducting. So far that hasn't happened. If I feel that they cannot coexist, of course I'll have to make a difficult choice. But so far, knock on wood.
Well, we'll welcome you back to San Francisco with either fiddle or baton. Let's hope you can come back and talk with us soon.
Thank you very much, David.
Let's hear a bit of that introductory cadenza now, music of Carl Nielsen and his violin concerto, as performed by Nikolai Znaider. Beautiful opening introductory cadenza of the Carl Nielsen Violin Concerto. Two great Danes, three great concerts. Tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday at Davies Symphony Hall, violinist Nikolai Znaider. With conductor Stefan Denev. Leading music of the Carl Nielsen Violin Concerto, also on the program, Guillaume Conesson's A Glimmer in the Age of Darkness, and selections from Serge Prokofiev's ballet Cinderella. Information at sfsymphony.org. I'm David Latulippe. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW. A reminder that our programs are archived at our website, kalw.org. If you've got a segment suggestion, send me an email, david@kalw.org. Thanks, as always, to Neil Swinkles for producing the show.